Hello, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast, a show about education and how it can change the world. I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and this is Episode 1, Lest We Forget. Whether you're an educator, a parent, a mentor, or a student, our purpose is to engage, enlighten, and empower you to make a difference. The teacher in me is so excited about this new format to share content and characters who've been a part of the Freedom Writer journey since the very beginning. Since I'm often asked, as an English teacher, why did you teach the Holocaust? We want to start there. That really is the genesis of our story. So in this episode, Carlos, the student who raised his hand and asked that question, is going to shed light on that magical moment that started our revolution. In addition, a segment on the show that we'll do regularly is called Diary of the Day. We'll be looking at passages from the New York Times bestselling book, The Freedom Writer's Diary, for my beloved students that will bring context to everyone we are interviewing. But most importantly, what I cannot wait for is to introduce each and every one of you to my dear and beloved friends, Claire and Renee Firestone. Renee is 94 years young, and we're going to hear about her incredible, harrowing journey from Auschwitz to America, along with a revelation of her roots to her daughter, Claire, who is an activist in her own right. We've packed so much into this first episode. It is powerful, it is poignant, it is provocative. So you're not going to want to go anywhere. Have some hankies handy and stay tuned for this amazing journey. Here's Carlos.
Being a Mexican-American, growing up in Long Beach, and it was a lot of gang violence. Hispanics sticking with Hispanics, blacks with blacks, Asians with Asians. Especially around that time, there was a lot of problems with everyone against the Hispanics, all the gangs against the Hispanics. I wasn't a gang member. I used to be a tagger. I just will stick to my own. It was 1993. Ms. G actually being a student teacher, walking in for their school. There was an incident that happened in the classroom. There was a paper that was being passed around, and it turned out that picture was making fun of Sherrod. I was like, wow, he's gonna come back with a kind of comeback or something, but he was actually pretty hurt. I thought it was funny, we all did, but that's when Ms. G actually took the paper and saw it, and she started talking to us about racism and what the Nazis did in World War II. She mentioned something about they were making fun of Jewish people, drawing them with big noses and stuff like that back in the Holocaust. So that's when the big question came up. That's when I raised my hand and I asked her, what is that? What is the Holocaust? She asked everyone, do you guys know what this is? And you're like, no. So that's how we moved on. That I lived in real life, that actually changed me completely all the way around. It changed my ways of thinking towards other races. It made me realize that we all get cut, we all bleed the same color. Everyone has a story. You have a story. If it can make other teachers better, it makes me feel great. It's an honor being part of this. Honestly, I wouldn't change it for anything in this world.
Room 203 was a home for the Freedom Writers, and after they graduated and used their wings to fly, we realized our story wasn't done. The next chapter had to be written. So we created a foundation, the Freedom Writers Foundation, and at first it was simply to help the Freedom Writers. But as they grew, the foundation was an opportunity for the Freedom Writers to pay it forward. And their idea was, why can't every single classroom, why can't every single teacher, why can't every single kid have the opportunities that we had? And so the foundation's idea is that every class, every kid, and every community can succeed. And hopefully this podcast will be an extension of just that, giving people an opportunity to find hope, to find their voice, to take risks, to be a bit bigger, and certainly a lot bolder. So the fact that Carlos is part of this foundation and part of this movement is so endearing to me. And why this first podcast is so special, because Carlos, as well as the other Freedom Writers, truly believe that we are here for you. our hope is that you will reach out to us. Either you can send us a voice recording, or you can write us an email at podcast@freedomwritersfoundation.org. Now, our next segment is called Diary of the Day, where another original Freedom Writer is going to read an excerpt from our book, The Freedom Writer's Diary. Today's diary is Diary 21, and it will be read by Sue Ellen Alpazar.
Dear Diary, I'm still swallowing the facts and information from our panel on diversity. All the panelists came from different backgrounds, but each had faced discrimination because of their race, class, religion, or gender. Despite their background or their past, all of them went on to become very successful. The last speaker was Renee Firestone, who lost everything, including her family in the Holocaust, but still came to America and became a successful clothing designer. Her daughter, Claire, came to the event and told us what it was like to be a daughter of two parents who had been in the camp. Surprisingly, after everything that had happened to her parents, they raised her not to have a prejudiced bone in her body. Renee told us never to judge people collectively. It's so easy to lump people in a group and label them, but that's how the Holocaust started. By meeting these people, it made the books that we've read more meaningful. It also made me realize that anything is possible.
I'm so proud of the original Freedom Writers, everything they are and everything they are becoming. Since they graduated from Wilson High all those years ago, they've matured into teachers and techies, principals and parents. Some of them are novelists and nurses, architects and activists. And they're impacting lives everywhere they go. They speak at schools. They challenge business leaders. They do video chats that interact with teachers and students across the globe. If you're interested in bringing a Freedom Writer to your school or to meet your organization, let's make it happen. Send us an email, tell us about your needs and your area, and let us serve you to help your students feel engaged, inspired, and motivated to learn, and more importantly, to live their own story in real time. That's what the Freedom Writers Foundation is here to do. So the time has finally come, and I couldn't be more excited to introduce you to our featured discussion today, my conversation with Renee and Claire Firestone. It is a new year, and it happens to be the 20th anniversary of the Freedom Writers graduation. And I am so excited to be sitting between two of my favorite people on the planet who have been with us since the beginning of the story. And so I'd like to introduce both Renee and Claire Firestone, who I like to believe are the catalyst for our journey, our discussion today, and everything that I've been able to do as an educator. We're going to be looking at the past, the present, and more poignantly, a call to action for the future. So I'd like to begin by welcoming both of my lovely ladies and wonderful friends to our first inaugural podcast. This is episode one, and it's really exciting to be sitting in your lovely home, taking this journey yet again. So thank you for being willing to be a part of this. And I'd like to start by going backwards to go forward. Renee, we met you at the Museum of Tolerance in 1994. That's 24 years ago. On April 13th, you will be 94 years young. You were as beautiful then as you are now. But it wasn't your beauty that captivated us. It was your words. And you actually wore a sweatshirt that said, "Lest we forget." I don't know if you still have that sweatshirt.
Oh my gosh.
But I will never forget that sweatshirt, a burgundy sweatshirt with the words, "Lest we forget." Tell me why that sweatshirt and those three words were so important for us to walk away, because we have not forgotten all these years later.
Well, you know that I'm a Holocaust survivor. And of course, I don't know how important it is to other people to remember, but to me, it is very important to remember, never to forget what happened to me, and to share it with other people so they can imagine what can happen if people continue killing and the hating. You know, by now I was hoping that the world will change and everything is going to be wonderful, but it isn't.
So as we're having this dialogue, I envision the listeners learning different perspectives. We're going to be reaching teachers and students and their parents. What I don't think a lot of listeners know is that before Schindler's List and an Academy Award and Steven Spielberg shining a light on the subject matter, people didn't talk about it in public. What is that like to tell your story that happened when you were a teenager, to know that you've been able to reach millions of people?
Well, you know, it is really not about me. It doesn't matter how I feel about that. The most important thing to me today is whether my audience understands why I'm telling the story. And like yesterday, I spoke to a group of police officers. I personally almost attacked them because I asked, you know, the world is in trouble. Very similarly like it was during the Holocaust. What are you guys doing? I said to them yesterday. What are you doing to make this world a better place to live in? So, as I say, it's not important what I say. What's important is how they understand what I say.
One of my favorite anecdotes that your daughter told me was before you actually did tell her specifically your story, as a child, she noticed the tattoo on your forearm from Auschwitz. I would like you to give me what the forearm reads, and then I would like Claire to tell me what you told her as a child, which was not the truth, and how she finally discovered what this tattoo on your forearm symbolized. Because I think that's a really great anecdote about parents and children not knowing how to ask the question and give the answer. And I think for a lot of our audience, there's going to be parents and children who haven't had those difficult conversations about the hows and the whys of our past. But I love that anecdote from both of you. So I'd love, tell us about your forearm, and Claire, tell us about the discovery.
Well, you know, she was a little girl, and I'm sure she saw the tattoo on my arm. It's just say A for Auschwitz, I presume. 12307, the number, which I was. We were told that we are no people and that we have no names and this is who we are, number whatever. And so I say, I remember when she was a little girl, we never talked about it. I don't remember whether she questioned it at the time. I didn't even know whether she noticed the number. But one day we were traveling on the bus and I was holding on to the, you know, strap. And a young man turned to me and he said, can I ask you, what is that number on your arm? And I said, oh, this is my boyfriend's telephone number. And Clara tells me afterwards, you know, mother, that's not true. You don't have a boyfriend. So then after that, we started to talk about it.
So I love this image of cute little redhead Claire on a bus. What was that like to hear your mom exchange those words with a stranger and have that kind of light bulb moment of, something's not right?
Well, that story on the bus happened after a story that happened in our house where I had a schoolmate come over and asked me, what's the number on my mother's arm? And I thought for a minute and I couldn't answer the question. I didn't know what the number was on the arm. I could have been maybe 8 years old, you know. So I said, I don't know, I'll have to ask my mom. So I went over, just as innocent as you please, and asked my mom, what's the number on your arm? And she said, well, just go tell him that it's my boyfriend's phone number. I didn't want to forget it. So by the time I heard the story on the bus, I mean, I knew that that's not true. My mother didn't have a boyfriend. She had my dad, and he was no boyfriend. So I knew that she was telling a story, but I didn't know why. I didn't understand why she told that story to an adult. I mean, to a kid, I could understand. You want to give kids information, particularly about the Holocaust. You want to give it in age-appropriate format, but to an adult, it seemed funny to me that she would say that.
Speaking of storytelling, Renee, what I've marveled at is watching both you and Claire be chameleons with any audience, children, adults, teachers, police officers. What I suspect is the most difficult audience was an audience of one, your daughter. How do you begin to peel back the layers of a story that happened not only to you, but to your husband, Claire's father, who also was a survivor? Where do you begin?
Well, you know something? I don't even remember. I don't remember whether it was my husband, who also was a survivor, whether he was the first one that talked to her, or whether I was. I don't, or whether she found it out somewhere else. And I'm sure that all those details from me came in pieces. I didn't sit down and told her the whole story of the Holocaust. So she heard it piece by piece and how she put it together. You know, when people hear the Holocaust story, they really have to analyze it in their own minds and put it together so they can make some sense of it. Because the truth is, there is no sense to the Holocaust.
You can't make sense out of the madness.
Yes.
But for you as a daughter, hearing bits and pieces from your mother, from your fabulous father, Bernard, may he rest in peace, what was that like for you, putting these pieces together like a puzzle in the house when she was on a stage in conversations?
The way that I in particular grew up, I didn't really have family here. We didn't have too much family left. Later on, my mother's brother came with his family, so I had a little more family. But then a few years later was my mother's cousin and his wife and their family. And then came those that were from the same area. Survivors tended to stay together by area. So in other words, all the Polish survivors would group together, all the Hungarian survivors. They found family in their community, literally.
And you were so, part of the Czech community, the Hungarian community?
Well, Czech-Hungarian. It was sort of a combo. I won't go into the history of the area and how it changed. I'm really Czech, but we spoke Hungarian. So that Hungarian-speaking community was all together. And what would happen is, in their exuberance of having new life, they would have parties all the time in their homes. And one thing that was pretty universal among most children of survivors, we never had babysitters. The parents went, we went. Wherever the parents went, we went.
Do you think that was because they didn't trust the
you
system?
Bet.
Okay, that's interesting.
You bet.
That is really interesting.
Didn't trust anybody. And they weren't going to let the children out of their sight for anything, as
that's
a matter of fact.
That's a-
and the parties were almost all the same. They would play cards. There would be a huge table spread out. I mean, huge table spread out and piled. As much food as you could pile on that table, there was food.
Okay, the Freedom Riders can thank you both because they call me a Jewish grandmother. Every time we have a Freedom Rider event in honor of the Firestones, I bring way too much food. That is because of you.
So as they gathered around the table, we were always eavesdropping, and the conversations would go like this. Look at all this food. Isn't that delicious? You remember when we were in the lager? We had no idea what a lager meant. That was the concentration camp, was a lager in German. Or they would say when we were in camp. Well, the only camp we knew was summer camp, and it certainly wasn't the same thing. You remember when we were in camp? All we wished for was a slice of bread or a piece of potato, and we had no clue what that was about. We couldn't conceive what they were talking about. So they would make these comments about what happened in their past, but without a context for us.
Wow.
And it isn't until later, when we got a little bit of history in school, that made a little more sense of what it is they were talking about. So we knew our parents had a terrible event that happened to them. We knew that people were killed in that event. But, you know, we watched TV and we saw wars on TV. I saw cowboy westerns where people got killed. So when we heard that people got killed in the Holocaust, that wasn't a totally foreign concept. But really, it wasn't until I was 13, I think, that the original Diary of Anne Frank, the film, came out. And I went with my mother. And suddenly, in watching that film, there was a scene that came on, and everything now clicked. The light bulb went off, and I now realized, oh, this is what my parents and all their friends were talking about every time they got together and talked about the lager, the camps, and what had happened to them. That was my first really awareness, even though by osmosis I got all the stories in bits and pieces. That sort of congealed.
Renee, when you were in a place of isolation as a teenager and there is no food and there is no family, what is that like to have lost all of that?
In the camp, while we were in the camp, which was for me a whole more than a year in Auschwitz, the daily food was a slice of bread in the afternoon with either, I remember we had to put out our hands like this, and they slapped a spoonful of sugar beets in it. Or on the Sundays, they gave us a slice of salami with that slice of bread. Now that was our daily intake. In the morning, we just got a liquid which wasn't even coffee or tea. It was something called ersatz, which later we found out was made out of some grass tea. And that was our intake. So imagine having one slice of bread with a bite of something next to him, your daily intake for a year. You know, today I know a lot about the Holocaust. When I was in camp, I didn't know really anything. For example, I found out many, many years after liberation that we were drugged. It makes sense, because if we wouldn't been drugged, can you imagine the millions of people that wouldn't have done some uprising, something, some trouble? We did nothing. We were like zombies.
Renee, I also remember you saying in one of your presentations that when you got off the cattle car at Auschwitz, you'd been on it for days, you remember having a moment where you actually saw Dr. Mengele, the angel of death. And because you were blonde and because you were blue-eyed, there was this moment that you guys caught each other's eye. And I want you to explain that.
That was already when we were inside. When we went in and we had to get undressed to wait to take the shower. And Mengele walked in with a few other officers. They were walking by. We were the naked women there, in thousands of naked women. And they just walked in, you know, like. And then they stood aside, and we could tell that they were talking about us. And one of the prisoners behind me taps me on the shoulder, and she says to me, "Renee, that officer over there wants you." And I look over, what is she talking about? And there is Mengele doing this to me. I'm standing there naked, 20 years old, and I turn away, pretending it wasn't for me, maybe it was for somebody else. And then this girl again behind me taps me and she says, you better watch it. And I look over again and again. He goes like this. So I walk like this, walk over.
Covering yourself. And
yeah, terrified, shaking like a leaf. And when I get there, he always carried a little whip. He puts it under my chin and he lifts my head like this to a light. And I spoke German. We studied German in school. And he says to the other doctor who was, I didn't know at that time that he was also a doctor in Auschwitz. He says to him, blaue Augen, blue eyes. And then, why are you here? He asked me. And I thought that everybody was Jewish there, of course. Why would he even ask me? I said, because I'm Jewish. And he says to me, who was Jewish Your mother? I said yes. And what was your father? Jewish. Impossible. Unmöglich. He keeps telling this other doctor. Das ist unmöglich. That's impossible. And I see that my friends are already moving up. So I turn around and run back to the line. And a capo comes over to me and starts beating me and starts yelling at me, "You idiot, you don't know, you could have been shot." You know, that I ran away from Mengele. I had no idea what it all was. They shaved our head and then we took a shower. We had to take a shower. And there was a pile of clothes that people took off and they didn't want, so they put it in that pile, and they told us we can take a dress and put it on our bodies. When I was finally liberated, I was walking for 3 months. We had no transportation.
Wow, I think a lot of people probably don't know as much about liberation.
Liberation was different in different places. Like in Germany, it was very different. We were in Poland. In Germany, they put them into, the Americans liberated, so they put them into camps and started to feed them. The Russians just opened the camps and said, go.
Imagine that. So you're 20, they yes. open the door, you're emaciated.
And you're free.
And you're yeah. free, and what does freedom
not
taste like?
Not a penny in your hand, not a pair of decent shoes on your legs, not a sweater or a coat, but a dress what you lived in for more than a year, and you're walking. It's January.
And did you, were people kind and compassionate, or were you turned away?
Some were, some weren't. Some people recognized immediately, you know, comes from the lager. But we were very lucky because where I was actually liberated was 6 kilometers from the Czech borders. So I immediately crossed the border and went into a restaurant in that town. And the restaurateur, the Czech restaurateur, immediately recognized where I come from. And he fed us and let us stay in the restaurant overnight so we don't have to be on the street. That was our first night, liberation.
There's a beautiful, complicated story that is now the subject of a play that you are developing about you and your daughter and your granddaughter. But I'd love for the listeners to know the symbolism of your choice of a name for your daughter, because it's so beautiful, and what it means to you and ultimately what it means to your daughter.
Well, you know, I went to camp with my 16-year-old sister, whose name was Clara. We were together for 6 months. Mengele came every day to roll call and selected people out. But this was 6 months later at the selection. They took her away from me. And I still saw her after that in another camp through the wires. But then a few weeks later, she just didn't show up and I didn't know what happened to her. And after the Holocaust, a few months after I got married, I was coming out of the beauty shop, I remember, and it was pouring rain, and I was running home and got into this room, which was, we had an apartment which had rooms around, and in the middle there was a room which was in the middle and had no windows. So I ran in there because I was terrified of lightning and thunder. And I fell asleep there. And in my sleep, I dreamt that my sister came to me. And I remembered how she opened the door and walked in and sat down next to me where I was lying and said to me, "You know, I came to tell you, you will have a little girl and you have to name her after me and you will never forget me."
I think knowing this part of your story explains your beautiful symbiotic relationship you have with your daughter. For our listeners, I'm going to give you a homework assignment. Both Claire and Renee are the subject of an Academy Award winning documentary produced by Steven Spielberg called The Last Days. And some of what we're discussing actually unfolds in this brilliant movie. Both Renee and Claire retrace the roots of you going to Auschwitz and then going home. And one of the scenes that I found the most provocative is you go back to Auschwitz. You look for records and in anything that can make light of what might have happened to this beautiful sister of yours, and you actually get the answer. And the answer in and of itself is so startling. And I'd love for you to share about that, because I think that probably put pieces for your daughter together as well, because she knew about your sister, but because you didn't know what happened to her, therefore she didn't know what happened to her. And then you're learning this together, what actually happened to this beautiful 16-year-old girl. So do you want to share what happened?
Well, we went to film The Last Days to Auschwitz. And they asked me, would I go into the archives and see if I could find any document proving that I was there. And while I was going through the archives, I found, of course, my own document, but I also found others, my father's and my sister's. I knew that my mother's won't be there because I knew that my mother was killed from the railroad station immediately, so she wasn't even registered in the camp. When I looked at my sister's document, it looked different from all the others. So I went over to the archivist and I asked him, could he explain what this document shows? There was a stamp on it which said Hygienic Institute and a name of a Dr. Munch. And I said, well, who is this Dr. Munch and what is this, Hygienic Institute? And he said, well, that was a clinic here in Auschwitz. He said, but I don't know, Dr. Munch lives in Munich. He says, I give you his address and you can write to him and maybe he can explain to you what this document says. While I'm talking to the archivist, of course they are filming all this. So the filmmaker comes over to me and says, oh my gosh, Renee, you don't need his address, we are going to interview him tomorrow, Dr. Munch. So he says, you can ask him. So next morning we fly to Munich and they go in to set up for the interview, and the filmmaker says to Dr. Munch, and Dr. and Mrs. Munch were together, and he says to them, you know, there is a survivor out there who would like to come in and show you this document to explain, you know, what it is. And Mrs. Munch says, survivor, you can bring her in here. I won't let her come in here. She can't come in, you know. So they come out and they tell me that I won't be able to show it to him, but maybe they will take in the paper after the interview and see if he would explain it. By the way, I'm sitting on the truck for 9 hours while they are interviewing Dr. Munch. When the interview is over, he goes over to the doctor and says, doctor, this woman is sitting out there all this time. All she wants is to show you this document to explain to her what happened to her sister. And he says, well, okay, bring her in. But tell her if she's going to be provocative, if she's going to ask me questions I don't want to answer, I'm going to walk out on her. So they came out warning me, you know, you can come in, but be very careful not to upset the doctor, not to ask such questions. And I agree. All I want him to tell me about the document. I walk in. And he's standing at the living room door where they were interviewing in the living room. And when I come close, he reaches for my hand. And I can't believe it. I mean, the Nazi doctor is going to shake hands with the Jew. This In Auschwitz, you couldn't even dream such a thing. But he's standing there with his hand out. So I reach for his hand, and while I'm holding his hand, I look up above him on the wall, and there is his picture in the Nazi uniform, the doctor in Auschwitz, and next to it is Hitler's picture.
It's amazing that all these years later, he has a picture of Hitler in his home.
57 years later. And my heart just started to pump, not beat, pump. And I see Hitler's picture and I say to myself, he tells me not to be provocative, not to ask questions. 57 years later, Hitler's picture on his wall. So he invites me in and he was sitting on a little bench and they were still filming. And he sits down and points to next to him. I should sit next to him. And I sit down and now I can't wait. I can't wait. Whatever will come out of my mouth, I don't care. He walks out, he walks out. And I turned to him and I said, Dr. Munch, they told me that you were the head doctor at the Hygienic Institute in Auschwitz. And he sits up very proudly. Jawohl, jawohl, he says to me. I said, I was wondering, they also told me that what you were doing all day, you were experimenting on Jewish women and children. And I was wondering, when you came home, could you make love to your wife? His eyes opened, but I don't wait for an answer. I said, they also told me that you have two children. Did you talk about your work to your children? Did you ever tell them what you were doing all day long? Or I said, maybe when you put them to bed, you were telling them bedtime stories about your work. And now he jumps up and he yells at me, I never told bedtime stories to my children because I had an aunt who used to tell me bedtime stories and I used to have nightmares. He's standing now. And I turned to him and I said, well, doctor, imagine the nightmares your children would have had if you would have told them what you were doing all day long. At this point, he sits back and I grab this paper that I brought from the clinic and push it in front of him, hoping his curiosity is gonna take it from me. Sure enough, he takes the paper, he's still standing, and he says, oh, that's my clinic, and sits back down. And I said, yes, doctor, and I point to my sister's name on that paper, and I said, and this doctor was my sister. And I was wondering, what kind of experiments did you perform on my sister? And he turns to me and he says, we did only harmless experiments. I said, if they were harmless experiments, doctor, why did she die? He turns to me again and he says, she didn't die in the experiments, but we couldn't send them back to tell everybody what we were doing here. We had to get rid of them. We shot them. That's how I found out. I'm sitting there listening to this.
I'm curious for your daughter. What was that like for you to hear this in real time?
What makes me angry is the cavalier attitude with which he tells the story, that this was like an everyday occurrence.
Yeah.
You know, you work in a laboratory. Imagine I work in a laboratory and I'm experimenting on little mice, and when the experiment is done, we gas the mice and we kill them, you know, because I don't need the mouse anymore. I'm done with my experiment. Well, but you're talking about a human being. I want people to listen to this picture I'm going to draw for you now, because this is going on still today, things like this in other parts of the world. A beautiful, innocent, sweet-natured child of 16 is marched off through the snow to a wall and shot. No one there to care, no one there to witness, no one there to comfort her in her terror. She knew she wasn't going to survive as they were walking her off. She had to know that they could never send her back to the camps. And the thought of that is not only horrifying to me, unbearably sad, but it angers me also that this man, a doctor who's sworn to uphold life, could be so cavalier.
When we look at our past, we have to understand it so we're not doomed to repeat it. And I look at your rich present of being advocates and fighters. What do you want for the future? What do you see for our listeners? What do you want to say so they can feel empowered, so they have a legacy, that they can get courage from your ability to not be a victim, but to be a survivor?
I tell you what my most important message today to teachers and to the kids is. Put your telephones in your pockets and start talking to each other. I mean, there is no communication anymore. People don't talk to each other. People don't know each other. How can you hate somebody you don't know? I mean, maybe if you hate somebody and you get to know him, you realize that he's your best friend. That's my homework for the children. Start with the children, because they have to learn to speak to each other. I'm sure there are kids that go home and the refrigerator is open, no food, goes hungry all afternoon or all evening. Does your friend who has plenty in the refrigerator know that? Does he invite you and say, come, you can have a sandwich with me? People have to help each other, have to be kind to each other.
I think about that a lot, by the way. It consumes me. And we were talking about this earlier. In today's world, you can certainly be depressed all day long with what's going on if you listen to the news. On one side, I'd say stop listening to the news and go do something positive. But you have to be informed. Technology is great, and especially with social media, we have a tool for transmitting information. But that's not really communication. Communication is I look you in the eye and I connect with you. I really can't do that on a screen. I need to see your eyes and I need to see your face for your reactions to what it is I'm saying and how I'm saying it. To the youth, I want you to learn more than anything to think critically, question what you hear, question what you see. Verify that what you're getting as information is true, because very often what you hear is not true, and truth is power.
To honor their truth, lest we forget. And with that, my friends, we conclude our very first installment of the Freedom Writers Podcast. This episode was produced and edited by Bryce Sirier, with production assistance from Clay Amator and music from Killer Tracks. We are so grateful you spent this time with us, and we hope you come back for more. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with folks you know. Help us spread the word, share the hope, and pass on the message of freedom, so together we can lift, learn, and live our stories to the fullest. Our call to action is simple. May we seek the truth, may we listen to one another, and may we ask ourselves, just as Renee challenged those police officers, what are we doing to change the world? Until next time, my dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.